Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly. This is episode 55, recorded on February 1st of 2019. And if you're new to this podcast, this is a show where we like to get geeky about photography, about gear, about the industry in general. Sometimes it's about ethics and copyright. Today, we've got a fairly big gear story to head things up. I have a wonderful guest that has had inside knowledge as I have had for a little while. And I have been biting my tongue, and now I no longer have to. And neither does Frederick Van Johnson. Frederick, how are you?
I'm doing great, Don Komarenska. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. And, you know, it's been a long time since we've talked. You were on an earlier episode of Photo Geek Weekly, and I think it was a really well-received episode. We've continued to grow since then. But catch me up. What have you been up to lately?
Oh, man, there's been so much. How long do we have for this show?
Typically we're an hour, but we can run along if you have an anecdote or two.
No. There's a ton of stuff going on. You know, as you know, I continue to sort of build on and refine the This Week in Photo entity, and that's going really well. As we all hope, as podcasters, the numbers are up and to the right. You know, so traffic is increasing, our reach is increasing, influence is increasing, which is great. We're finally in a position to do a lot of other cool things that I want to do. Like we spun up a new community early last year, I think it was, called the TWIP Pro community at twippro.com. And that's a paid community. It's $5 a month, and people come in and they can just sort of hang out. And the way that I position the TWIP Pro community is kind of like an airport lounge. You know, one of those exclusive airport lounges that you wish you could go into, but you can't because you don't have enough points or whatever. It's that, you know, but for photography. Whereas Facebook and that ilk of social network are the general population of a international airport. Where,
right, you know, you get a few extra dollars and you get rid of all of the riffraff, right?
You get rid of the riffraff. You can find outlets to plug into. You can relax, take a shower, you know, all that stuff. So that's what the TWIP Pro community is. And that community started as an experiment, to be honest with you. And it really shocked me that there's actually demand for people wanting to have substantive conversations with each other about photography beyond just a like and a, hey, good capture, you know, that sort of thing.
You know, so, it's hard to get rid of the noise, right? You know, whenever I post something online, I don't mind when people say, oh, that's wonderful. That's great. But I don't know. Maybe I should stop doing this. I have a compulsion to reply to every comment that somebody leaves on things that I post on social media. Mm-hmm. And so if there's a really kick butt image that gets like 50 comments on it, I'm not just going to scan through and answer the questions that some people have. I'm going to comment and say, thank you. I appreciate the compliments and all this on every. And yeah, I'm sure it's helpful to some degree for audience engagement. But then I look at my watch and it's been, I don't wear a watch anymore. I look at my phone and it's been like 3 hours, and all I've been doing is typing short little one or two sentence messages. And
it's a balance. It's a balance.
It is. I'm not going to say they're all not of substance, but there are so many of them that are just time wasters. I love when people give me authentic feedback, when they ask me poignant questions that answering it would help other people. Yeah. And it sounds like when you put that $5 paywall in front of it, you get rid of all of the substanceless commentary, and it all becomes much more meaningful, right?
Absolutely, yeah. That you hit it right on the head. That's what happens: is you get rid of the $5 filter or $4.99, whatever filter. It's for some people that's a lot of money, but for a lot of people, especially our audience, people that are spending all this money on camera gear and et cetera, and computers, whatever. $5 is not a whole lot of money, especially if it means that you can up-level the conversation. And you would be surprised. And the reason I did that, because I have experience with communities in the past where we have a Facebook group. Back in the day, way, way, way back in the early days of TWIP, we had a bulletin board style community on This Week in Photo. You know, one of those sort of plugins.
I remember that.
And you remember that?
And it was really tough. I think you commented that maintaining the level of discourse there was quite difficult, especially when people would just create random spam accounts and post adult oriented content. That you
That's why I killed it. Yeah, that was it. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. Was I kept having problems with people just posting pornography and, you know, all sorts of vitriol that was not helpful, let's say. So I you know, I issued a warning and then another warning and I say, well, that's it. And I just turned it off because, I don't want to put myself in the position to be distributing pornography through my website. Some people can do it. I'm not one of them, you know, so I basically turned it off. And you'd be surprised, or maybe you wouldn't be, but it was surprising to me to see that once you attach, I think that the dollar value to the membership is one thing, but the removal of anonymity, I think, is what, and the increasing accountability. So if you say something ridiculous or, you know, hateful, then people can find you. They can talk to you like a normal person versus you vanishing into the ether on Twitter or something, you know, with a mysterious account that you set up just to trash someone.
Well, you don't have to look any farther than YouTube comments to know exactly what anonymity on the internet will allow.
And it's bad. It brings out the worst in human nature. So, yeah, so that's one thing I'm excited about, the community and growing that and expanding that. The big thing that we're working on 2019, 2020, and 2021, hopefully and beyond, is really leaning into the concept of education and webinar-driven type content. From a live standpoint, you know, sort of speaking to what you were talking about, the idea of being able to help people and answer questions live and all that. So I want to bring that piece into This Week in Photo, as well as push the courses and things that we have going on a little harder so that we can sort of keep the lights on and keep doing what we're doing.
Yeah. Well, that might tie into the last story that we're going to talk about today, but we have a lot to discuss before we get there.
Yeah.
So this is a really fun week for me and you and anybody else that had knowledge from Panasonic that was under a non-disclosure agreement, couldn't really talk about it.
Yep.
Of course, Panasonic is one of my sponsors, so I had some inside knowledge of their upcoming S series cameras, the S1 and the S1R. And today is the big reveal. February 1st, we now have the ability to see all of the specifications, reviews, opinions, images taken with the cameras are being shared. And I'm looking at these specs, and it's funny because I had seen them in emails and other formats. Seeing them all succinctly put together here in an article I found from DP Review, it's really fun to just see what Panasonic has done and some of the huge pushes forward, some of the huge advantages over the competition in the full frame mirrorless camera market. I know what my favorite things are about this, but Frederick, let's start with you. What do you think about what's been going on behind the scenes to create these beautiful cameras, but what has you most excited, I suppose?
I'll begin with the end. The thing that has me most excited is A, full frame, obviously, on a Panasonic body, and then B, 96 megapixels in high resolution mode.
Yes.
And I know you have to be excited about that, because considering the kind of work that you do, that has to have your eyes dilated.
Oh, absolutely. I did a couple of test images with it, but and that's on the S1, mind you. That's the 24 megapixel camera.
Yeah.
Multiply that by 4 and you get 96 megapixels. Conversely, on the S1R, that's 47 megapixels, it has a 187 megapixel high res mode,
which unheard is
ridiculous. And I can't wait to find a purpose for that.
just to play with it. It's interesting. I was talking to the Panasonic people a couple of weeks ago about this feature, because they have a similar feature on the G9, right?
Where it goes up to 80 megapixels.
It goes up to 80, and it does basically shifting the sensor around. They're leveraging the image stabilization technology that they have in the cameras that sort of precisely moves the sensor to counteract movement. So they're leveraging that to sort of move the sensor around to capture 4 different images or multiple images and then put them together to create this high resolution image. But the problem on the G9 is ghosting, right? That was an issue. So if you take a photo of anything that has any sort of movement in the scene, you're going to have challenges with the final image. So which limits the things that you can take pictures of, right?
Well, even, you know, taking pictures of, like I did some tests with that with a fluorescing flower, right? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of glowing under ultraviolet light. Yeah. But even a flower, if I set it to, I think the longest I could do was a 1 second exposure. But, you know, over 8 seconds, plus maybe a little bit of gap in between, a picked flower will slightly move, like a dandelion will wilt very, very quickly. And so even over 8 seconds, if something moves the space of a pixel or two, all of the edges of everything just become kind of a fuzzy, garbled bit of nonsense.
Yeah,
so when we talk static subjects, it really has to be static, like an unmoving landscape, for example, which I think is where that technology excels. But they've improved that here, I hear.
Yeah, and that's what I'm excited to talk to you about this, because you've actually, I had my hands on early prototypes, non-functional prototypes of the camera, but you have had the opportunity to sit down with the camera and actually shoot with it. They've added the feature or improved the software so that it apparently will remove or mitigate some of that ghosting. And I want to see how good that is, because if it works as well as they say it's going to work, then that changes a lot of things, you know? And like you say, what are you going to do with a 187 megapixel image? I can think of a couple things that some people would do with it, you know? I mean, from the standpoint of harvesting parts of the image to retouching to perfection to blowing, you know, video and panning around an image, you know, there's a million things you could do with that big image.
Well, and for macro photography, there's an advantage too. I mean, that's right in my wheelhouse, where the closer you get to your subject, the shallower your depth of field becomes. Mm-hmm. So what if you could be physically farther away from your subject to increase your depth of field without having to deal with diffraction, knowing full well that you're going to crop in on the data because 187 megapixels is too much? Mm-hmm. You might only need the original 40 or so, but now you've got the ability to have drastically improved depth of field with no compromise on the resolution you were expecting to begin with.
Yeah, no, no, absolutely. You know, it's interesting what Panasonic has done here with the Lumix S1 and the S1R. And I was saying this for years about Nikon and Canon. I was, you know, armchair quarterbacking their research and development department, but I was basically saying, it's not that hard. Why don't you just look at what everyone else is doing and do it better and release a camera that does all that stuff, right? And, you know, you look at this S1 and the S1R, and to a large degree, that's what Panasonic did. They're like, okay, people seem to really dig this Sony stuff, you know, and now Nikon's throwing their hat into the field. They've had some missteps. Canon's out there. What can we do that will, A, not cannibalize our Micro Four Thirds lineup, you know, and let people know that that's still going to be around, but also lean into the full frame space and give those people that absolutely need full frame what they need, and build a path of ascension from Micro Four Thirds all the way up through to full frame. And then on top of that, what they did was that, which you know intimately, the manufacturer sort of coalition, you know, between Sigma, Leica and Panasonic, right?
And that I think is the most brilliant part of this, because immediately you've got third-party manufacturers that are no longer third-party, right? Sigma is working directly. They are a first-party contributor to the system for creating the highest quality of lenses. And they can create their own bodies. And, you know, I don't think that there's any confirmation of a release date, but they said that they're pushing out a full-frame Foveon camera. And then you can interchange the lenses back and forth. It's a win-win, I think, for everybody involved in that scenario. But you made a fun point. It's like, oh, look what everybody else is doing and do it better. And they've done that on a lot of points down through this basic spec list. One of them that, to me, once you see it, it's like an aha moment. Mm-hmm. The viewfinder, the electronic viewfinder is 5.76 million dots. Now that's up considerably of the 3-point-something that the G9 was and any other electronic viewfinder that I've seen to date. And they have continuously been getting better. Looking through this EVF, I can say if this is as good as it gets forever forward, this is good enough. This, to me, rivals what an optical viewfinder would have been in terms of how much you can see, and of course has all the advantages of an electronic viewfinder. It is a marked improvement over any other EVF I've looked through.
And, that's high praise from you, you know, for considering, you know, the kind of work you do and considering how good the EVF is on the G9. It's pretty amazing on the G9, and to go up, what, 2.something million dots from that, you know. So I was going to ask you, I'll put it back in your court. So with the superior sort of groundbreaking electronic viewfinder, are you finding that, because there's a lot of pixels to push, right? Are you finding that there's a lag, any sort of noticeable lag or drag time between the image refreshing on the LCD and what you see?
It is really, really fast. And of course, I've been testing it, photographing snowflakes and other macro subjects. I mean, it's the time of the year for it. And so I love the fact that I can take a picture. And when I was using Canon gear for this, I would be focusing by strobe effectively. I'd have to keep the pre-flash on because the pre-flash is what I would see through the optical viewfinder to show me where I was going to be, because there was basically no ambient light. Yeah. And now in this scenario, the refresh of when I'm shooting would be 9 frames per second because I wasn't using any autofocus. And I would see a live image immediately, you know, one after the other after the other. And it was so fast. It did slow down a little bit in low light, but I haven't met an electronic viewfinder that didn't. And it performed better in low light than any others that I've experienced to date. So, there was that. I also tried shooting video on this thing. And, you know, Panasonic has been known for their video in the GH series of cameras on the Micro Four Thirds side. And that pedigree comes with them here. So I was using the S1, not the S1R, although I would have loved to have had the opportunity. They just gave me the S1, so that's what I ran with.
Boo-hoo, boo-hoo.
And, but actually, it has some advantages over the S1R when it comes to video, because you can do 4K 30 frames per second with zero crop factor whatsoever. It'll use the entire sensor. Now, when you're shooting 4K at 60 frames per second, yeah, there's a crop involved. And there's not much of a crop on the S1R. Just the number of pixels, the sheer amount of data that it would have to compress from 47 megapixels down into 8 megapixels for 4K, rough equivalency. They went with a 1.09 crop factor on that, as I'm reading from these specs. So a little bit, and that's not going to deter most people. I think that's close enough to using the full sensor that anything but the diehard video people will complain about. And really, it's not a complaint. If you need that, then you actually spend less money on the S1, and you've got all of that running for you.
Yeah, yeah. And in your opinion, actually speaking of video, Griffin Hammond is also a Lumix ambassador. And he released a new video. And I think I took a note. We had a meeting earlier today. I think it's called Argon. So if you do a search for Griffin Hammond Argon, you'll see a video that he produced with one of these cameras. And he's a video guy. So it's produced from the standpoint of what kind of quality can you get out of a camera like this shooting video. So that's exciting. And one of the questions I want to ask later, because we're doing sort of an impromptu group meeting that hopefully you'll be involved with as well, Doug.
Sure.
And that's the question of, and this is the question that Panasonic is going to get at this next trade show that they're doing, what WPPI is the next one that's coming up. And one of the big questions is going to be, do the S1 and S1R or full frame represent the sole direction of Panasonic, meaning Micro Four Thirds is got one foot in the grave and now they're going to put all their horses behind this? What do you say to that if people ask you as an ambassador?
Every camera manufacturer, aside from Panasonic and Olympus, they've got two formats going. I mean, everybody. Fuji has APS-C and medium format. Pentax has full frame and medium format. Nikon, they had their one system and that didn't do so well. No. But they were able to put all the R&D into multiple systems at the same time. And the market dictates what will continue. I mean, if people stop buying a particular size or class of product, then, well, that's what happened with compact point and shoot cameras. I mean, yes, they're still on the luxury market, but you don't walk into a camera store and see 50 options to choose from a dozen manufacturers anymore. You might see one and you might see none. So I think that Panasonic, so long as the Micro Four Thirds system is attractive to us as photographers, then it will always continue. And I've got my, it's not here with me right now, I was shooting with it, the GX9. And that's a wonderful travel camera. I love it. And Olympus is pushing into weird directions with their massive OMD EM1X, which we just talked about on the last episode. So there's room to grow, but there's reasons why I want a small travel camera. I won't take an S1 or an S1R with me traveling across Europe. It's bulky and I don't need the features that it offers in exchange for the inconvenience that the size and the weight when you're traveling would be a frustration. So going back to the specs here, both cameras are fully weather sealed. Great. 6 frames per second with continuous autofocus. And they've got some crazy artificial intelligence mojo that they're putting into this. I'm not sure exactly how far along. I think I was reading on some of the stuff on the DP Review website that they were using cameras with firmware version 0.7. Mine was 0.5. So, features are constantly being improved and, nothing is really set in stone until it's finished. But when I was shooting 9 frames per second, that's more than enough for anything that I would personally need. And you can get that on either of the two bodies, which is great. I bought a very high capacity XQD card as I was waiting for these cameras to arrive. And shooting RAW, holding down bursts for hundreds of shots, didn't skip a beat. It just kept going. So that also makes me happy. That might not be the case if I was pushing 47 megapixels to the card at the same time, but at least with the S1, it was clear sailing and there was no issues. I personally purchased the NovoFlex L mount to, or the EF mount to L mount adapter so that I could use some of my Canon gear, specifically my extreme macro equipment, which is what I was testing. And I had been using that lens on the Canon 1DX and 1DXR, 1DX Mark II rather, for a long time. And the S1 is, I don't have access to the RAW files yet. There's no RAW converter available, but just judging by the JPEGs, it's as good or better in terms of the dynamic range, in terms of the clarity, especially at those extreme magnifications where diffraction comes in and no matter what you do, things start to get soft. It was as good as I think it could possibly be. So I'm sad that I had to ship it back to Panasonic Canada yesterday and all of my fun has been taken away, but I got images.
You'll get it back. I'm sure.
I'll get one back.
Yeah, you know what I'm also interested in is, there's obviously going to be the comparisons between Sony, the Sony full frame cameras in this. And with that comparison will come low light performance. Because it's your full frame now. You have all those pixels that you're scooping up. Can you shoot a black cat in a dark closet? can it do that? What has been your experience with the camera having shot with it? Did you play around with the low light performance at all?
I did, and it was great. I didn't do any direct comparisons between it and other cameras. As much as I like to pixel peep and do direct comparisons, it's how it feels to me and how it's actively being used as a product. And I had absolutely no qualms with the high ISO performance in a couple of the tests that I did. And, while I was shooting out at the base ISO, which is 100 now compared to the Micro Four Thirds standard that Panasonic had at base ISO of 200, we're now at 100. Mm-hmm. Some of the cleanest images I've ever seen. But then when I brought it up to 2, 4, even 8, I didn't see much of a difference at all. Really? So it was an incredibly capable device. The official specs say you get between 360 and 380 shots per full battery charge. But those numbers are like if I'm shooting rapid fire, as I do with my focus stacking subjects and what have you, I shot about 10,000 frames on a single charge. Now, that's shooting constantly, nonstop, 9 frames per second gathering, say like 300 to 400 shots at a time. And so that's not what the actual like listed standards for, I'm not sure exactly what ISO standard that the International Standards Organization has for batteries per charge. But it always has to be like a flash being used or right. a certain delay between shots and
ambient temperature. Yeah,
exactly. So I was very, very impressed with how long that lasted, which was about as much as I would get out of a 1D class body as well with its battery.
Crazy.
So
that's crazy. Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me of some of the issues that Sony had when they launched the A7 series. And one of the biggest complaints was people having to walk around with pockets full of batteries for that thing. Because it makes some great images, but the battery life back then was subpar. Apparently they've improved that, but of course, you know, they had to. But yeah, that's crazy. One of the things about this camera that I wonder is, and I'll preface this with, I still love my G9. I still love the Micro Four Thirds ecosystem. I love the size of the lenses. I love, you know, just the intuitiveness of the UI, all that stuff. So on the Micro Four Thirds side of it, which, you know, obviously a lot of it will leak over into this side. So I don't know if personally the S series cameras are for me. I'm more of a travel guy. I want to, you know, I want a less is more kind of environment. You know, I'm a MacBook Pro versus a full on iMac or Mac Pro or desktop machine.
And I'm sitting here with a 32-inch 4K display and a computer motherboard that has two separate processors in it. Yeah. You know, so
you're the opposite end of the spectrum, you know, so that, and you shoot ultra high resolution macro type photography. So this camera is, you know, was kind of purpose built for you, you know, and a lot of people like you.
But at the same time, I was shooting with the GX9, which isn't even a flagship camera from Panasonic, for over a year. And all of my professional work was done with that camera. Not only just to say I can do it, but when I'm in front of a group of students, when I'm teaching a workshop and I'm holding like a $7,000 camera body, they think, okay, well, I can't afford that much camera. Yeah, so I can't get that high quality results. And so when I was shooting with a much smaller camera, it really showed people, you know, it's all about the technique. It's all about how you use the camera, where your creative inputs come in. And yes, certain equipment can let you push limits farther. And having that high resolution, I think, is one of those elements that will help me push farther. I've got a 140-inch tall print in a museum right now nearby, the Simcoe County Museum. If anybody's in the area, I've mentioned it before, but the exhibition is now open and it runs until April. So it has a 1.2 gigapixel composite of all of my snowflakes up to the point where I had made that composite. And it was required. That resolution really made it work to that big size. So if you are doing like massive prints, not everybody is, but if that's what you're into, then this is going to be a huge advantage for you.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, of course, you've got the 5-axis in-body image stabilization, which works with a lens stabilizer as well. And where were the prices on this, Frederick? I don't see them on this. There we go. So the cost for the camera bodies, why am I missing that here? It's just giving me lens prices. I believe the S1 was $2,500, if I'm not mistaken.
It is, yeah, $2,497.
And the S1R was a little bit more than that.
$3,397.
Yeah. $3,397. But, I mean, you're looking at a flagship pro-level full-frame camera. That's right on par with what everybody else is doing. And in fact, in some cases, it can be less expensive depending on what camera models you're looking at. They also announced their three lenses. We previously had known the focal lengths of them, the 24 to 105, the 70 to 200, and the 50 millimeter. Now we know all of their apertures. The 24 to 105 and the 70 to 200 are both f4 lenses, while the 50 millimeter is f1.4. And their prices are, you know, comparative to the industry. You know, the kit lens, which will be the 24 to 105, is at $1,300. The 50 millimeter f1.4, that's a pricey one. I mean, at least compared to the Canon one that I got, which was universally, you know, received appalling reviews for having soft corners and everything. So this one will be a fairly premium 50 millimeter prime lens at $2,300. and the 70 to 200 will be at $1,700 when they debut. So it's going to be an investment for anybody that wants to jump into the system. But Sigma is going to be making lens adapters. So you can just bring along your Canon lenses, your Nikon lenses, you name it, to this platform and hit the ground running. That's what I've been doing with my macro gear at the very least.
Yeah. Yeah. Larger lenses. I'm fairly sure. Correct me if I'm wrong, because you see the world as in zeros and ones. But I'm fairly sure that the Micro Four Thirds lenses are not going to go on these lenses, just because of the field of view, right?
I think it has more to do with the flange distance, actually.
You can't adapt up to a larger sensor, right?
Right, but I think that it's. You would have to like physically have the mount, have the Micro Four Thirds lens inset into it, into the round circular body of it, which I don't know if that would be possible. So, and even
or if you'd even want to do it, right?
Exactly. Why would you necessarily want to do that? So, I was, and this is just me. Nobody else cares about this. I was disappointed that when I took my my Leica Stemmar 3D lens. I was excited to try this because it requires a full frame mirrorless camera. Mm-hmm. It is the only M lens connected with the M to L adapter that Leica makes that will not fit on these cameras because it has a protruding rear piece that's designed to split the image from each lens so that they don't cross-contaminate each other. And just the way that the internals of the body is, it just won't fit. So I'm working with a 3D modeler to redesign one that will fit and have it 3D printed in aluminum. And then I'll paint it black and I'll retrofit the lens to make it work. But
yeah, I was going to say, just get some pliers and pull that thing off of there, man.
Yeah, well, but if you do, then there's crosstalk between the two lenses and the images will just get kind of blurry. But
I'm kidding. Of course.
I'm literally the only person on the planet that cares about that. So we'll just leave it there. So this is exciting news. I'm personally... this is the camera that I've always wanted. You know, professionally, of course, Panasonic is a sponsor, but if they weren't, this would be the camera that I would be buying next, because I was always on the fence about going to a mirrorless full frame, and I loved what Sony had out. I loved what the other manufacturers were coming out with, and it just wasn't enough to tip the scales for me. But this does it.
It's so, there. Yeah. Welcome to the future.
Welcome to the future. All right. Let's go to the past, actually, for the next story here. So this has it has some ripples and repercussions in the film era of photography, which we like to touch on once in a while here. So there's two stories that we're going to talk about together here. Number one is the photochemistry manufacturer and supplier Tetinol is facing closure, and they're reportedly set to close up the shop after a prolonged search for new investors failed to secure its future. We talked about the financial struggles that Tetinol was in. Basically, after they had manufactured a bunch of material, but there was delays in doing so, and the person that placed the order canceled the order, and they had a ton of inventory of, I'm not even sure what it was, that they couldn't sell, because they were a business-to-business type of enterprise, not a business-to-consumer. And at the time, there was rumblings that they might try to do some crowdfunding and bring about a business-to-consumer type approach. Doesn't look like that happened. So Tetinol, if you're not familiar, Frederick, they are a behind-the-scenes manufacturer of chemicals for other brands. So if you've used chemistry from Kodak or Ilford, there's a very good chance that Tetinol will have manufactured at least some of the products that you use, even if it doesn't have their name on it. Yeah. So this has an impact for those people that still shoot film. What do you think about this? I mean, it's not a sustainable business model if you're trying to be a photochemical manufacturer as if it's the 1950s.
I have strong opinions on this. So I think, you know, first of all, Tetinol, I probably have, you know, some microliters of that in my blood from all the processing that I did throughout the days, both with Ilford and Kodak. So, you know, I'm no stranger to photographic chemical processing. But you know, I look at this as, you know, and I don't want to anger anyone who looks at this sort of purest art form of, you're not a real photographer unless you're shooting film and processing your film and printing your film and, you know, doing all that. But I appreciate it being a niche, sort of like building a ship in the bottle or something like that. But as evidenced by the last story we covered, technology for photographers and image capture and content creation is miles beyond the old school of chemical processing. And notwithstanding the environmental impact of all this stuff. And some people will argue that, yeah, digital cameras are full of all these harmful chemicals and all that as well. Yeah, but there's no factory like this that's creating toxic chemicals. So I'm negative. You know, I'll go on record and say that I know there are lots of people, and I have lots of friends like Doug Kay and lots of other people that love to shoot film and process it, or shoot film and scan it in or whatever. But I think that this, we're witnessing the sort of death throes of printing, you know. And I know how to print. I had a dark room in my house for many, many years, you know, and I loved it. And I go in there and print and, you know, spend hours and come out with an okay print. You can perfect that now with today's technology. So long story short is I think that the world of chemicals and dip and dunk processing and Kodak, you know, those sorts of technologies are in our rearview mirror now, and that we're moving forward towards these new technologies that allow us to tell stories and get the what's in our mind's eye out and in a more accurate and beautiful way than we ever could with chemicals and all that. So I know that's controversial, but that's how I feel.
You know, you make very, very good points. You know, there are some people that still like to listen to vinyl records, not because mm-hmm. it's a higher quality medium, although they might argue that too, but it's definitely a different experience.
Yeah. Analog.
And some people are after the analog experience. It just puts them more in touch with things, and they want to have that tactile response. But at the same time, if Tetinel goes out of business and there's no other suitable manufacturer for some of these chemicals, it's not like some new upstart is going to come in there and say, hey, we're going to start, you know, mixing.
We're
going
to scoop up that market.
it's not going to happen. So when these people start to disappear, then unless all of the manufacturers for these chemicals disappear, and then there's a demand for somebody to come in on a very niche scale at a very high price to manufacture it, you'd almost have to become a chemist yourself and start mixing all of these volatile compounds together like you had to do way back in the, 1850s mm-hmm. of photography.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because Kodak has also just announced that they are bringing out their Ektachrome, which they just relaunched in a number of formats up to 35 millimeter. They've announced that they're going into 120, which is medium format, and even sheet film too. Mm-hmm. So if Kodak is in a position to not only bring back a product, but there's enough demand for it at different sizes to bring it back into the niche of like a 4x5 shooter, which, by the way, Frederick, I'm not sure if you've ever seen a 4x5 slide reversal. But they are just gorgeous. I mean, you could frame that and have that sitting on your window and have it backlit, and it's just an incredibly beautiful thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I used to shoot that stuff. I used to shoot, I've shot 8x10 film before. And it's, let's put it this way. I'm old enough to have photographed on 8x10 film, 4x5 film, you know, 120 and 35 millimeter, you know, and some other obscure formats that, you know, but and not only photographed on them, but processed them. And if it wasn't a transparency, printed them as well. So yeah, I'm like you mentioned, the romanticism of the analog process is easy. And I say this to people that go camping, right? Like I like camping. I don't love camping. I like camping. And I can say that because I spent many years in the military deployed and camping. so you had to do it, you know. It wasn't a, hey, let's go on vacation and rough it, you know. You literally were doing it because you had to do it. Same thing with this analog film stuff. You know, I spent many, many years in a dark room never seeing the sun because we'd show up before the sun came up, process and print all day, and then by the time it's time to go home, the sun would be down again, and we were in a dark room all day. So, you know, so I look at those days and I'm like, okay, you get good at it, you get competent at it. But then back then, the the level of preciseness and just sort of fun was not, it was there in some ways, you know, sort of dodging and burning and doing all that kind of stuff and having control and, you know, the fun of listening to music in the dark room while you're loading up rolls of film and doing the dip and dunk. That was all fun in a process. But if the end result is just tell a story and to show an amazing image and to do that, you know, that sort of content creation, these sorts of things are I believe, like the Kodak, you know, the Ektachrome ilk of products are relegated to people like vinyl. Yeah, it's fun. And, you know, there's this sort of kind of hipster beret wearing romanticism about it. But in the end, if it's all about the image, then you need to use the right tool for the right job. And it's 2019 now, and we have some amazing tools that we can use that don't require, you know, getting chemicals in our blood or harming the environment or any of that other negative stuff.
That pretty well puts a pin in it. I have a romanticism for film, as I know a lot of other people do, but it's not a strong enough one for me to actually go ahead and do it. Like, I'll buy, like, I've got a couple of rolls of Ektachrome. When it was first announced, I went to B&H and I bought 3 rolls. They're sitting in a drawer unopened, and they might stay there until they expire. They might not.
They should be in your refrigerator, by the way. Put them in the fridge.
I do have some film in the refrigerator, but I'm at the quota of what spousal approval will allow.
Okay. So, at some point, food has to go in there.
Exactly. I mean, will I take it out on a photo walk? Well, maybe, because I've got some really interesting film cameras that are just weird conversation pieces that would be fun to take out with a group of photographers and just chat about.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that becomes part of the experience, because every time I go on a photo walk, I don't ever end up getting anything really good. So I take weird, quirky cameras with me and have conversations with photographers, which is what I'm going there anyways to do. Yeah. And so for me, that's maybe that's my niche. Maybe I need to go on more photo walks.
From a business standpoint, I don't think a Kodak or anyone else that's sort of building a business on the analog film industry can sustain waiting on people to say, you know what, I think I'm going to grab that film camera. I know I'm not going to get anything good, but I'm going to grab a film camera and go out and take some photos with it.
That's not a sustainable
market is
business
big enough
model
to keep those factories open, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, speaking about closures, the next story is one. It's a little bit close to home for me. And this was, as we're recording this, I'm not sure if it's been publicly announced. It's going to be announced this afternoon that the Arcanum is shutting its doors. So the Arcanum, if you're not familiar with what it was a platform created by Trey Ratcliffe a good number of years ago that encouraged a master and apprentice type learning environment. So me being a master within the service would have a number of apprentices that would be under me. I think you could have up to 20 in a particular cohort, but you could have different cohorts on different topics and different levels, sharing different interests, etc. And I had 2 of them going at one point as well. And it was a fun environment where you would have these people that we would do weekly hangouts. In fact, we still do, and we'll be doing one tonight. But it was all about volume. Right. If you couldn't fill up the cohort, and if there was not enough apprentices to fill up all the different niches and to have all of these different masters and to have all of these different levels, then it could very easily become stagnant. And you get that type of volume with big marketing dollars, big push, big investment. And the Arcanum never really got that, unfortunately. Yeah. They started off with a bang, then it slowly started to go down and down and down. And of course, it was heavily built on the Google Plus platform. And as we know now, Google Plus is going to be shuttered much sooner than previously expected, I think in April. It's
which
closing
is coming
up.
Right up, right around the corner.
Coming right up. So I got a note earlier today that the Arcanum is officially shutting its doors on February 28th. This is what I alluded to at the beginning, Frederick, where you're kind of, you've got a community learning thing, you've got courses, and so you're in the photo education space. So I'd love to know your opinion on what is now a failed experiment. It was successful for a while, and I think a lot of people have had value out of it, but it ultimately has come to an end.
Yeah, yeah, it's sad. It's sad to see that happening, but at the same time, not. And I say that because Trey Radcliffe and that team are friends of mine, right? And I consider Trey in many ways a mentor in terms of his relentless entrepreneurial spirit and vision, you know, to see things in the chaos that we normal mortals can't see. And this was an experiment. You know, Trey Radcliffe is a, you know, he and I have spoken before. I've done many interviews with him on This Week in Photo. And he is the sort of consummate, or he was a gamer, right? So that whole world of gaming and cohorts and master apprentice leveling up and all that came from his love of gaming and all that. So, you know, I'm sure, you know, I can imagine, I wasn't there, but I imagine one day he was sitting around like, hey, what if we tried to take a fresh look at education and use this master apprentice? And he did it, right? Most people would say, you know, wouldn't it be cool if, you know, someone did this, this, and this? Trey Radcliffe says, wouldn't it be cool if, and then he executes on it.
And it was great, especially in the early days when Trey was more actively involved in the platform. I remember you interviewing him a while ago, and he had stated that the Arcanum had now become profitable. They were taking in more money than they were spending on a monthly basis. Yeah. And that was great. But it was also at a time where they had lost their CEO. And their general support staff and their footprint of what costs money was disappearing because they had already developed the platform and the development costs are then in the past. So it was sustainable to a point, but you know, I was kind of disappointed that, you know, after the initial launch, Trey did not stay as actively involved. And the guy's doing so many different things. Yeah, I don't blame him for focusing.
He's a real photographer. Elsewhere. He's traveling the world, taking pictures, you know, beating up that camera.
But we wouldn't hear from him for like a year. That kind of made me think, okay, well, you know, if Trey is not backing this wonderful thing he created, then who is? And so I don't know any inside baseball specifics, but I do know that they were trying to find investment and it never came. And because it's so heavily laden on the Google Plus framework and their APIs, which are shutting down some of them even before the full Google Plus shutdown, then there's no budget to rework something that is, you know, instead of going up and to the left, it's going down and up and to the right, down and to the right, and it's just going to hit a zero level at some point.
Well, so. I would place bets on Trey in team in terms of reinventing and skating to where the puck is going to be with this. You know, so I'm sure, you know, you haven't seen the last of this education type effort. Knowing Trey, he'll reinvent this into something that we didn't know we needed, kind of like Apple, right?
Well, exactly. And I welcome that because there are so many ways to educate photographers. And so, I mean, you're familiar with online marketing material and you pay X number of dollars to get, you know, X course packages. And then there's the 5-day deal stuff that, you know, you can get all of this content.
It's crowded.
And there's subscription services all over the place. It is quite crowded.
Not to mention from a content creator standpoint, the platforms that are available to you today are exponentially more vast than they were just 5 years ago. I mean, you've got services like Teachable, teachable.com. That's where the TWIP school is located. There's Udemy. There's masterclass.com, which you can subscribe to. There's Lynda, obviously, if you want to do your own course. There's even services that are popping up that are sort of next generation, I call them, that are sort of minimalist in nature, very clean, very 2019, 2020 design. There's a service that comes to mind called Podia. PODIA.com they're taking a fresh look at how to deliver online content and online education. And you can sign up for a couple dollars a month and start delivering your own content. So the barriers to entry for that sort of thing are lowered. And then you sort of layer on that, looking at this through the lens of, you know, why is Arcanum going away? You layer on top of that the different modalities of learning that people have, right? So not everyone wants a master apprentice thing. Some people are shy and they'll never participate. Some people can grok everything they need from a YouTube video and then go out and execute. Some people need to have their butt in a seat in a classroom and have someone like you tell them and tell them and tell them, and then they finally get it. So, you know, it's a bifurcated multiple faceted sort of industry online education has become, and attacking it from one vector, I think, is, you know, it's hard. It's hard, you know, but it was a good experiment.
And, you know, like I do a lot of one-on-one workshops. Somebody wants to, you know, pick my brain here in person in my studio, then, you know, come on over, you know, we'll take out all the obscure, weird photo gadgets and things, and we're going to tinker until we get something to work. You will see my creative process firsthand. You will be involved in that process, and you'll learn how to adapt that to yourself. Some Which people love to learn that way.
Yeah, that's golden. I mean, to have that, to have a master at something and to be able to rub elbows with them while they're doing stuff and get into there, that's a nuance that you cannot, I don't believe you can replicate that online, where, you know, you're in a room with something, with someone, and you're just joking around with them, and you're, you know, working on a shot and figuring out all the millions of little nuances that go into that shot.
It's funny, because I did a macro photography course with On One Software, and it was really, really well received. Now, if anybody wants to check that out, you can go to onone.com/donkom, D-O-N-K-O-M. But it in one of those courses, I didn't even know what I was going to, like, I knew what I was going to do, but I had no idea how I was going to execute it, what the end result was going to turn out to be. I was going to try and take this wonderful piece of, I think it was quartz and fluorite crystal that had these interesting little caves and stuff on a very small macro scale, and get an ant to cooperate in that scene, to sit there and kind of stare into a light. I recorded this whole thing, I put some crazy music when I sped up the whole time when I was actually trying to get an ant to go where I wanted it to. Yeah. It just had to sniff out the little drops of sugar water that I had put, and then it would stay there because then it would start drinking the sugar water.
Oh, interesting.
But to get it to do that was like a half an hour of frustration. Then I had ants crawling around my studio, because when one ant doesn't cooperate and ends up on the floor, well, you go grab another one. You round them all up and you put them back outside afterwards.
You need to call Ant-Man to help you with that.
Exactly. But that's one obscure scenario, but nobody can be asking me questions when I'm doing that. Nobody can be inputting their own ideas and asking the what ifs and have them automatically be part of that creative process. So there's so many ways to learn. And I've been a master with the Arcanum since pretty much the very beginning. I'll ride it out for the last month. But to be honest, it was not really that lucrative for the masters either. I mean, I've got 9 apprentices right now, and from that, I make between $300 and $400 a month for the amount of effort that I put into it. And you know what? If I had doubled up the number of apprentices, then yeah, that number would double, but it's still not a huge amount on the monthly basis for the amount of time that one should be committing to that.
Yeah, how much time were you putting into it for that $300 or $400?
It depends, but I don't know, maybe 15 hours a month.
I can imagine what your hourly rate is to hire you, and that's nowhere near
my hourly rate. So now in the last few months, it's quieted down a little bit. I mean, my input to the system is based on what I see. And I always do once a week, a 1 to 2 hour hangout with everybody. And so that's half of that time there as well. Sorry to see you go, Arcanum. It's been fun, and it has helped. It's been a piece of the pie for a long time. It's helped pay bills. It's helped put down money on the house that we live in now. Back when I had over 20 apprentices, there are other places to learn. If anybody wants to learn, you can go to Frederick. You can come to me directly. You can go to any of these resources, or you could just watch YouTube, because I do a ton of that too.
Same here.
And fiddle things out.
I would also throw in there, keep an eye on Trey and what they're doing over there at stuckincustoms.com.
They've always been doing great work for educating photographers and offering you better ways to do things. I mean, he's been involved with I believe it was Aurora HDR, making, because he was known for the HDR work, and he had a very important role in in helping design what many consider to be the best HDR processor on the market today. And so there's a ton of innovation coming out of those guys. So we'll see what comes next on that one.
Yeah, he's even helped with Peak Design, you know, with the bags that they're putting out.
At those least are one, nice bags too.
One series of the bags. I don't know if he's still involved with them, but I remember when they first launched the Everyday Messenger bag, that was with input from Trey Radcliffe and team. So
yeah,
cool stuff.
Awesome. Well, let's get into the final section of the episode, and that would be the picks of the week. So, Frederick, do you have any idea of what you might want to share with our listeners about what interesting gadget or software or app or anything you can think of?
Sure. So I would throw out there, and this was my pick of the week on my show, so I'm just going to recycle it.
Sure.
I'm a big fan of online learning, sort of continuing this trend of online learning. And I mentioned masterclass.com. Have you heard of masterclass.com?
I've heard of them, yeah.
Yes. So I'm a fan of masterclass.com. I'm borderline addicted to their content over there because, you know, from a content creator standpoint, I just love the way that they produce their content. I love the way they've laid out their site. I love the way that they just sort of do business over there. And I love the fact that they've standardized on bringing celebrity experts in a certain field on to teach you about the thing that they became celebrities doing. Right. So, you know, you've got, you know, Serena Williams or Venus Williams, whatever, them teaching you tennis. You've got Usher teaching you how to sing. You've got, you know, famous comedians teaching you stage presence and those sorts of things. Famous authors teaching you what their process is for writing. And it's not just, hey, we're on a scale, you know, not just, but the production values are higher than what you'd normally see on YouTube or whatever. They actually have a full on crew that goes there and lights a scene. Like with, what was it, James Patterson, they rented out a bar in New York City, kicked everybody out of it, and had him sitting at the bar like he's your uncle or grandfather or something, explaining to you how he comes up with his ideas for stories. That's priceless, you know? That's one. That's awesome. You got to look at that stuff and think, was this possible 10 years ago? If I wanted to sit down, you know, I'm interested in becoming an R&B singer, and I want to sit down with Usher and have him tell me how he became an R&B singer, how he holds a crowd while he's dancing on stage, all these different things. If I wanted to do that, that would probably have been impossible. But now I can do it sitting on my laptop, you know, with headphones on, and sort of Matrix style ingest all that information into my brain and learn it. And I'm excited about it because there's a couple of new courses that were just released. The name of the authors escapes me, but they're on storytelling. And I've been harping on storytelling on This Week in Photo forever, that, you know, photographers are doing photos, but there's usually, depending on the experience of the photographer, what we've noticed is there's very, very few photos that are up there that have story attached to them. So reaching outside of the photographic genre and into literature and, you know, script writing and those sorts of spaces, and learning how they do it, and then taking that knowledge back into photography, saying, hey, well, how do I build a story based on how Hollywood builds stories, based on the hero's journey? You know, how do I take that knowledge and put it into photography and make something really cool?
So we are visual storytellers, right? And yes. So that it's not just about the equipment that we use, it's the stories that we tell. And that can also be in terms of writing.
Yeah.
When I post an image online, I love to tell people exactly how I shot it, make it a bit of a narrative of the creation process so that people can take that and learn from that as well. You need to have writing skills if you want people to comprehend you when you're talking about complex things.
Yeah.
You know, you need to have speaking skills when you want to stand in front of a group of other photographers or do a presentation. I do them sometimes to high schools and what have you, and to have them understand you in a way that everybody is nodding and following along rather than having their eyes glaze over. Communication skills, regardless of from what facet you look at it, can be learned and improved, and will improve your job as a photographer.
And yeah, so, I think it makes you a better human as well. I mean, just we are storytellers, and I tell you, I don't know if it's a factor of me getting older or in more curmudgeonly or whatever, but when I get text messages from, you know, my girlfriend or whoever, and there are like misspellings in there, or, you know, not that I'm a grammar Nazi or whatever, but, you know, I look at it, I'm like, this is the way we communicate today. You know, we use words, and we have the ability to sort of tell stories and string words together elegantly, you know, and I feel like that's being lost a lot, either in our text message or Instagram postings or Twitter postings, or even in photography and how we do things. And I think if you're searching for a way to distinguish yourself and differentiate yourself from everyone else, it's easy. Just like learn English or whatever your language is, you know, write it correctly and build story into things that you do. Learn how to tell a story.
Exactly. Right? People will respect you more for it. I mean, like, I hate when I get a text message or an email from somebody that I know they wrote on their phone and they use the number 2 instead of the word T-O. Because, you know, I know you have to press the button to switch to the numbers to get to the 2. Why didn't you just put the T and the O there? It just, maybe I'm, you know, I get off my lawn old grandpa at this point, but
I'm happy to be on my lawn. I will happily stand on my lawn and scream because we're losing language. I mean, I don't know about in Canadian schools, but in U.S. schools, you know, they no longer teach cursive handwriting.
Yeah, well, they don't teach it here either. I know
it's gone. I'm like, what? Come on, you know.
But my daughter,
pretty soon they won't be teaching you how to tell time on standard round clocks, right? Because everything's digital. Why do you need that? Or you can just ask your personal digital assistant to tell you what time it is.
Yeah, you don't even have to read anything. And here I am with like an ancient Nixie tube clock sitting on my desk. But that's another story.
Yeah.
Okay, so my pick of the week is something that is really useful and really inexpensive for photographers of any class. They're called a crab clamp. It's basically a little tiny clamp that you can get them in bigger sizes too, but the ones that I use are small. You spin a little thing and it closes the clamp up. You spin it the other way, it opens it up, and it's got tripod threads on the bottom. This is the ultimate tool for attaching a LED flashlight to a tabletop tripod. And people have been asking me about this for a long time. They've seen me use them in videos and things like that, and they can never figure out what it's called. Because if you don't know, it's called a crab clamp, and you just type this little tripod holder thingy, you won't find it. It's called a crab clamp. And you can buy them in packs of 2 for $17 or $18 on Amazon. They're not expensive. Get 2 or 3 of them because you'll find multiple uses for them. You can get them on a bigger scale, and they can hold lighting equipment or other things that you're using to build a set. Not just for the tripods and the flashlights, but little things like that. And having that as part of your toolkit, you'll come across a creative problem. And you're going to look into your kit and say, what piece of gear here solves this problem? You will be going back to this crab clamp multiple times for many different reasons that you don't even know you're going to need yet.
Love it. Love it. And those are the tips and techniques that we need from pros that have walked over the hot coals and have figured out that, you know what, this solves it. So now... Now you can just go get it and solve the problem.
Exactly. Like I used to be using gaffer's tape to tape the flashlights to tripods and things like that. Works, but it's not a nice solution. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Photo Geek Weekly. Frederick, where can people find you online and all of the stuff that you're doing with This Week in Photo?
Yeah, well, I'll give you 3 locations. So This Week in Photo, the podcast, and, you know, it's sort of my Rome, right? All roads lead to thisweekinphoto.com. And from there, you can reach our school, which is at school.thisweekinphoto.com, and has our courses for sale. And also our community that we mentioned at the top of the show, and that's at twippro.com. All those entities are linked to from thisweekinphoto.com. And I encourage you to subscribe to us there. You can find us on YouTube. You can find us on Spotify or Stitcher or Google Podcasts. We're all over the place.
And if you're subscribing to Frederick and you haven't yet subscribed to us here, please do that as well. You can find the show notes for this episode at photogeekweekly.com, and it'll include all of the links that Frederick just mentioned if you want them in one place too. Thanks to everybody that continues to support this podcast. Every once in a while, somebody puts some money in the tip jar button that I have on the website, and that keeps me well caffeinated for these episodes, or it helps pay for the hosting fees, which none of this stuff is free. No. I'm doing it really for fun. I don't have any sponsors for the podcast at this particular point. That might change in the future, but I'm just having a blast doing this. And thank you guys for listening. And at this point, I guess it's time to get out and shoot.